Thank you all so much for being here. This is the second event in our new Thursday Nights in AI series. This event is co-hosted by Outset Capital and Generally Intelligent. Outset Capital is an early stage fund run by me, Josh, and our third partner, Kanjoon. We invest in pre-seed and seed companies. We're backed by the founders of Dropbox, Quora, Replit, and more, and are actively investing. So if you're building or you know someone who's building, please come say hi. I am full-time on the fund. Kanjoon and Josh are not. They are also building Generally Intelligent.
Generally Intelligent is a research company, and we focus on making more generally capable, robust, safer agents, systems that act in kind of digital environments, like on your browser and your code editor, that sort of stuff. So we do research to basically make, like, imagine AutoGPT, but working.
Tonight's guest is Aravind Srinivas, who is the co-founder and CEO of Perplexity AI. Perplexity AI recently raised a Series A led by NEA. He's also backed by Nat Friedman, Elad Gill, and AI luminaries like Jeff Dean, Jan LeCun, and Andre Carpathy. Perplexity AI is the world's first generally available conversational answer engine that directly answers questions about any topic. And we'll dive into what that means in this conversation. Aravind previously earned a PhD in computer science from UC Berkeley and worked in AI at OpenAI, Google, and DeepMind. Thank you so much for being here. Let's just start off with the basics. Most of these people in this room probably know already, but let's just start off. What is Perplexity AI, and how does it compare to what's out there already?
Yeah, so Perplexity is a conversational, I would say, an answer engine rather than a search engine. So what does that mean? Since the beginning of time, like, the fundamental human need in top of the triangle of human needs is curiosity, the need for information, right? The beginning of our race, like, we used to rely on asking other people, and then people stored knowledge in the form of books, and then we had the printing press, and then we had, like, libraries, and then internet, and then organized sources of information like Yahoo, and then actually, like, algorithmic search like Google. But still, we were just consuming links. But at the end of the day, what we really want is, like, answers and getting things done. So we really need answer bots and action bots to just do what we want them to do and answer all our deepest questions, right? People wanted to do this forever, but there's a reason it didn't happen. We didn't have this amazing technology called large language models. But then the world changed December last year, once ChatGPT came out, and 1 week before that, GPT 3.5 updated version came out. And we figured that, like, combining the power of these large language models with tool use, which is search indexes or databases that have all the facts, so combining the facts engine, like a search engine, with the reasoning engine, like a language model, helps you build an answer engine that can answer all your questions, can converse with you and let you ask, dig deeper, ask follow-up questions, and share all this knowledge easily with other people so that they don't have to ask these questions again. So that's sort of what we are building. We started doing this in December last year. We launched it a week after ChatGPT. And many people gave us no shot at succeeding, but we have still survived for 8 months. So it's going pretty well. Traffic is growing, so you should check it out. For most searches now, it's pretty feature complete with, like, whatever you get on Google in terms of, even if you're not interested in an LLM-generated answer and just want to get to the link quickly, the relevance from LLM ranking is lot better than what you get from Google, which is filled with SEO and ads. So there are a lot of people who just use it even as a traditional search engine, and a large number of people use it for getting answers. So that's where we are today, and we want to continue going on this journey to make all of us use answer engines and stop using search engines.
We'll talk more about this answer engine. I like that concept. But just to take a step back, like I mentioned, you were a PhD student at Berkeley, and then were working in AI at Google, DeepMind, and OpenAI, and then decided to launch Perplexity in perhaps, like, the craziest moment, one of the craziest moments. I guess every subsequent moment has been crazier in AI. And, like, why did you do that? What was the journey there? Yeah.
So I came from India here 6 years ago, and I didn't have any interest in startups. I just came to Berkeley for a PhD in AI. Deep learning, DeepRL was my topic at the time. It was actually the equivalent of LLMs back then when everyone was pretty crazy about it, but didn't have a real product impact. And then, you know, there was this TV show, Silicon Valley. I'm sure all of you have seen it. So I also saw that. Compression was like the core aspect of it, right? So lossless compression, how can you improve? So then you work on generative models. That's the ultimate thing. If you model the log probabilities of every next thing that you're going to predict, and you feed that into Huffman encoding, you have like lossless compression, but much better than JPEG. We started working on generative models, myself and one of my colleagues at Berkeley. He was the one who invented the working version of that, Jonathan Ho. We even taught a class on it at Berkeley. We didn't call it generative AI, though. We just called it deep, unsupervised generative modeling. So I learned a lot about it, learned about transformers, worked on like many internships at DeepMind and Brain. There was no way to convert all this into a startup because the hardware for compression wasn't there. Like, you have to make it work on device, right? So I kind of gave up on that idea. And when I was at DeepMind, I was mostly in the office, as interns are supposed to be. I would go to their library, and they had a lot of books. And some of their books were about the early days of Google, like how Google works, or like Indeplex and things like that. And obviously, I took it and read it while my jobs were running on the cluster. That story resonated a lot with me because I think in Silicon Valley, you're sort of typically romanticizing the idea of college dropouts and undergrads starting companies and becoming the next Zuckerberg, right? Or Gates, Jobs. But for me, it was like, oh, who are like PhD people who start companies? They don't have to be dropouts, but at least like academics turn entrepreneurs. And Larry and Sergey were the people who really inspired me a lot. So when I was at DeepMind, I would go and ask the manager of my manager, Oriol Vinales, like he's now the head of their Gemini team, what is the page rank of, you know, 2019? Like what is the equivalent of that? And he would just say, I don't know, but it's very likely Transformers. And like, you know, it was kind of correct. It's the ultimate test of time paper in AI right now. So I started working a lot on transformers in Google Brain with the guy who invented it, Ashish. Wrote a lot of papers, got a sense of like this really working, and then went to OpenAI to do more research. But clearly the times had changed. I would always keep hearing things like, oh, you know what, there's this company called Jasper or Copy that make a ton of revenue. And then the real changing moment was when GitHub Copilot turned on the monetization switch. Hundreds of thousands of people paid on day zero, double-digit million ARR in like the first day. That just shows it's like a real thing and clearly added a lot of value to people around me. I reached out to a few people like Elad Gil and Nat Friedman, told them I wanted to start a company. I didn't know anything. In fact, the first idea I proposed to Elad Gil was I wanted to do Google, but from pixels because they cannot be disrupted from text. So I wanted to do it on the glass. And there's this model called Flamingo from DeepMind that works. So we just need to ship it. And he was like, this is really like a cool demo thing, but you're not going to make it work. The hardware is not there. It's very hard to do distribution. He told me all the rational things any investor tells to an enthusiastic founder, right? But the idea of search just kept coming back and back. Like we tried Texas SQL. We tried a lot of other database search. But all of our core founding team was just so motivated by search that the inspiration from Larry, Sergey, or like me wanting to do search all the time, it just somehow flew into the product deeply. I think a lot of people say this, like listen to your inner voice. Whatever you ultimately obsess about, that's what you'll be able to put all your hard work on. Other things like do what the customer wants or like go talk to people and build something customers want. You need to be first motivated by it too. What is a problem you deeply care about? Like you have to work on it. So that somehow ended up being the case for us. And that became Perplexity.
How does Perplexity actually work under the hood?
Yeah. So Perplexity is basically the combination of a traditional search index and the reasoning power and text transformation capabilities of large language models put together. So every time you enter a query in Perplexity, we understand your query, we reformulate it, and we send it to a search engine that is very traditional. Multiple search indexes, not ours, and like external indexes, pull up the relevant links, and like lots of links, sometimes even hundreds of links. And then we basically task the LLM with saying, hey, you know, read all these links and pull up the relevant paragraphs from each of these and use those paragraphs to answer the user's query in a very concise way. And In your answer, write it like an academic or a journalist would write it. That is, make sure you always have supporting citations, supporting links. Every part of your answer should have a citation to it. And this all flows from our background. Like, we were academics. When we write papers, we always have citations at the end of every sentence to make sure that we only say what is truthful, right? Like a fact GPT or a truth GPT bias. And then that ends up becoming the answer. The LLM does the magic at the end. And we make it conversational. Remember the context of previous questions so that you can referentially ask more questions on top of what you already asked. We also make the process of asking more questions easier by suggesting follow-ups to you, which is also another LLM that generates these. So that way, the whole process of discovering more information becomes fun and engaging, and you kind of get into these rabbit holes of, like, which is, again, you know, our inspiration we took from Wikipedia of, like, asking more and more things by clicking on more links.
So when this started, was this just like a call out to, you know, OpenAI's API and that's it? Is that still the way it works? Are there a bunch of specialized models? Like, how has it changed over time?
Mm-hmm. We initially started off with GPT 3.5. I think it's still called DaVinci 3. That came a week before ChatGPT was released, and we already had everything in place, so we noticed a massive improvement in quality from that. And we also used the Bing API. So what we built for the first time, the first rollout, was just API calls. But now it's a lot more sophisticated than that. There's like many different LLMs, including ours, many different indexes, including ours. It's kind of like playing the orchestra. Like, there are so many tools, so many parts, moving parts, and your job is to play the orchestra where you deliver a lot of value on top, reliably, at scale, lots of queries per second, and making sure the latency is really good.
How do you think about building on top of other APIs, whether it's OpenAI or I'm sure Google have their own kind of commercial API, et cetera? How do you think about kind of having your own business on top of that? Like, is that defensible? Like, what do you say to the people that are, you know, sort of haters on the, oh, it's like just a wrapper around OpenAI or whatever?
I think if it's just a wrapper, many people will be able to build it really quickly. And then if it's just a wrapper, it'll be hard to scale it to this level of traffic and usage and reliability, latency. All that requires hardcore engineering on the back end. But long-term defensibility is only possible if you have, like, either you have, like, so many users, like, the product is so good, users just love it and they don't care what you use under the hood. And so you got the user love, the network effects and the stickiness, retention is all good. That's hard to buy. Like, once you have the user love, no, whether you have your models or not, it's very hard to, like, lose from there. But in terms of asset class that you want to own in your company, obviously it makes sense to invest in your own models, invest in your own search index. I mean, I would even go to the extent, like, these days people make fun of LangChain wrapper companies, right? Not even OpenAI API companies. So fortunately, we're not LangChain wrapper because when we started, there was no LangChain. So we kind of built our own LangChain, I guess, basically, right? So I would say, yeah, it makes sense to build your own models, your own indexes over time. But there's, like, two ways of building a company. One is you roll out a product, get a lot of users, de-risk the product market fit phase, get to a sufficient user volume, and then you start investing in infrastructure. So you raise the money needed for that, and you build a company out of it. The other way is saying, like, I'm going to first build the infrastructure, and then I'll build a product later. So only two companies have, like, I would say even only one company has done that successfully, right? It's OpenAI. Anthropic has built models, but not a product. Like, nobody uses Claude as a product, but they use it as an API. That's kind of worth doing if you're interested in building infrastructure business and maybe a product later out of it, but more centered around infra, right? That requires you to raise a lot of money at a really high valuation, which is mostly impossible for most people. And even if it's possible, it's super risky. So we decided to do the traditional way of, like, raising small amount of cash, build a product without any infrastructure of our own, and then later start slowly building it in.
That makes a lot of sense.
To be clear, are you saying that the plan is to eventually move off of OpenAI or to build your own models to work alongside OpenAI's?
So right now the plan is to build our models to work alongside OpenAI's. I expect OpenAI to have the best models for at least 2 to 3 more years. nobody knows the future after that. Like, it could be some other company or it could be us. Nobody knows, right? So I'm just willing to be pragmatic here. Obviously, look, if you ask anybody in this room, would they want to be the owner of GPT-5? Like, they would say yes, right? So I'm also going to say yes. I would love to have our own model that's as capable as the next LLM being built by OpenAI. But what is practically feasible today is, like, we probably can get to 3.5, but we can never get to 4 with the funding we have, and definitely not to 5, right? So we are happy to work alongside their APIs.
I love your approach. It's just very pragmatic. Not as sexy or exciting sometimes as people who are raising like 100 million to just build models and start there, but it just strikes me as very pragmatic the whole way through.
I'm not making fun of that approach. In fact, I'd just be more direct and say I'm not bold enough to do that. Because if you want to raise 100, your valuation should be at least like 500 or 600 or like billion maybe for some people. After that, what? What if you never build a model as good as OpenAI? Or like, what if next day they announce their API is 10x cheaper? Actually, they did do that. Then what happens to you, right? And then what if NVIDIA comes with a completely different GPU in a few months and you invested all your cash into building a cluster out of the old generation? There's so many problems to think about when you deal with capital of that size. And as a first-time founder, I don't have the guts to do all that.
You have achieved a remarkable amount, especially since, as you kind of alluded to, the odds were against you. Everyone was like, well, you obviously can't do this. And you're like, well, let's see. You posted on LinkedIn, I think yesterday, with some interesting stats comparing Perplexity to Bard and ChatGPT. So you cited Perplexity has 0.7 million, so 700K visits per day. Bard has 4.6 million. ChatGPT has 54 million. So ChatGPT is by far the dominant product right now. But you asserted that ChatGPT might be the dominant product, but Perplexity is the best product. When you look at visit duration, pages per visit, and bounce rate, Perplexity is the clear winner above ChatGPT and Bard. So those are just very impressive stats. And I'm curious, how do you think you've achieved this? Obviously, there are many companies following in your footsteps, not to mention Bard and ChatGPT. What is it about your product that has led to these great stats about user love, basically?
A lot of credit goes to our team for that. We have really good engineers and a really good product designer also. One of the most appreciated aspects of the product is it's very clean and simple. So why did we get these statistics? I'd say the number one reason is we only focused on this one thing we are doing, which is answer engine, supportive citations, nothing else. There are a lot of decisions we made, like, oh, if we could have gotten more traffic if we supported free-form chat instead of just being a productivity assistant or research assistant. But we didn't do that because that would mean bifurcating the product, make it confusing to people, getting users for one thing, and like some of the users are getting frustrated for lack of reliability on another thing. So that really helped us. It was clear, simple, and only doing one thing at a time. ChatGPT has so many other things going on that they could lose on one plugin or one particular functionality to a company that's super focused on nailing that, right? And that's what happened for their browser plugin, or their Bing plugin. As for Bard, I think it's still improving since they rolled it out. And I think they are trying to go after ChatGPT than like trying to kind of create a new search experience there. So they hallucinate a lot and like they don't say the right things. And some of the links are not real links. But that's the same problems you have with ChatGPT. So if you kind of go after ChatGPT, you end up with the same problems it has, right? And another reason they are disadvantaged is because if Bard is basically replacing Google, it's not good for Google. So they might not invest as many resources into Bard as they would do for regular Google.
Just want to ask about that because that's kind of every founder's, every builder's question. How do you prevent or cut down on hallucinations? How have you approached that issue?
Yeah, like I said, the core tenet of the product is only say what you can cite. That's also the principle in academia or journalism. Like, you need to have sources. So if you're only going to pull up content from a link or a web page and only use that content for writing the answer, you can reduce hallucinations a lot. Despite that, there's still some misunderstanding for the LLM where, let's say I'm searching for Ali Rhodes, then there's some other person with that name. It might combine the two together to one person. And like some people get offended by it. Some people are entertained by it. So we have worked hard on like disambiguation. You know, there's a long tail of cases where it goes wrong. That can be addressed with a better LLM. For example, we've noticed GPT-4 hardly makes any mistake there. As long as you can decouple the facts from reasoning with this retrieval augmented generation paradigm, some people call it as RAG, it should be possible to address this over time. And as long as you can parse web pages even better, the snippeting logic is better, the embeddings are better, all these things can over time just be reduced to like practically zero, right? No one's going to be angry if 1 in 1,000 queries are factually like having some problem. And at least we've been tracking metrics and we're realizing that we're continually improving here.
Last question, and then we'll open it up. So get your questions ready. But just kind of talking about the psychology of building this, being a founder is just always incredibly difficult. And that's just in normal times. Right now, the ground is moving so fast beneath you. OpenAI is moving so fast. Google is moving so fast. Other companies are moving so fast. And then every other day you have a 100 million or billion fundraising announcement, new people coming out of stealth with just huge piles of money. And I'm curious how you kind of deal with that, of like just all the challenges of building something new, plus being in this world where like you kind of have to be on Twitter, you have to be monitoring what's happening because things are moving so fast.
I think it's always fun to prove the world wrong, right? Like that's nothing better than that. When Peter Thiel's like whole 0 to 1 book is based on this, like what does the rest of the world think? What do you think? And is it at the intersection of what is right? And if that is the case, then you'll end up being incredibly successful. Regarding the funding round, if having more capital lets them build that you're trying to build much faster, then you're obviously at a disadvantage. So for example, if your company is about building GPT-4, and you have $10 million in funding and somebody else has $500 million in funding, they're likely going to win. If the company is about, you know, taking Llama but building like a really great assistant out of that for healthcare, and having $500 million in funding doesn't necessarily make them win. In fact, it might make them lose because they have way more in capital and they'll get distracted and hire a lot of people and like throw a lot of cash at things that don't need to be worked on. And you have much more advantage because you're lean and you're basically hungry and you need to win, right? Scarcity cannot be faked. Like the one who has more at stake, basically the one who has like so much more to gain from winning eventually wins. So yeah, I wouldn't get so distracted by funding rounds. For example, the Inflection funding round doesn't change any of our destinies at all. That's more for OpenAI to worry about, right? So for products that are competing with you in the same space, there you clearly need to be competitive. No question about that. It's good to just focus on your own journey, have a high sense of urgency. And Nat Friedman has this thing on his website, like a bunch of bullet points, which I really like. Some of them I remember I can share now, which is get your dopamine from making things happen. I really subscribe to that. A lot of it aligns with what Mark Zuckerberg says, too. Done is better than perfect. Always iterate. Don't wait for perfection. Get user feedback every week. In fact, like when starting of the company, Nat told us like every Friday, you should basically be discussing what your users are saying about your product. And if there's nothing new there, it means that week was a failure. So we took all this advice pretty seriously and we still work at that pace actually. It's gone a little bit slower because we have a product already and we can't keep shipping more and more because that confuses the user. But we still try our best to, every Friday we discuss all in an all hands, like what people are saying about the product, what we can improve.
I love it. Well, thank you for sharing your journey with us. And with that, I will open it up to questions. Natalia will run around with a mic, so please raise your hands. We'll start over here, second row. We'll just pass down the mic.
Hi, so you said earlier that you were building a search index. Are you using a retrieval augmented generation approach? And if yes, how often do you update your index or vector store index, and how do you manage to scale it so that your data store is up to date at all times?
Yeah, so I don't remember off the top of my head what is the exact periodicity, but it's pretty frequent, like at least happens every few hours. It is using retrieval augmented generation. So the necessary elements for this are like good embeddings and like good logic around like rescraping and things like that. And that is separate from actually the LLM.
So for the LLM and this retrieval augmented generation, are you still using the OpenAI API?
We still use OpenAI API. Yeah. We use some of our models too. And we expect that to be the case over time. Like in the sense, if there's like a sliding bar between our models and OpenAI models, and like there's like a convex combination between the two, we expect the sliding bar to like shift more towards our models over time, but continue to have like a non-zero usage of OpenAI.
What metric are you using to measure the relative performance and to compare the retriever performance between?
Yeah, so we're actually just setting all these things up right now. We have this thing called AI quality dashboards, and we're working on that with contractors. And the thing about this end-to-end system is you need to track basically whether the answer was correct or not. That's the most important thing. It's hard to have a metric for just the embeddings alone.
Part of my team is also an LLM researcher from ETH Zurich. And then whenever we also ship a product, and then whenever we are like iterating on the product, we have a meeting, and then at the end you're like, oh no, we need to build like a test set to test out how specifically well our retriever is. And so far we've never gotten to the point, but we're like always intuitive, like playing around, feeling like we're making some changes to the pipeline, see if it works better. How much of that did you guys actually do specific testing with like a benchmark, or did you just intuitively?
You tested on prod.
On product? That's what we're doing, but like every time we're like, oh, we should build a benchmark.
This is something I learned at OpenAI, that benchmarks are like really kind of overrated. It's like because we are all like indoctrinated to think like that from our machine learning research. But the moment you kind of train your mind to only test on real user testing your product, that's when you actually have something reliable and robust, right? Otherwise, you just start tuning for that benchmark.
Josh, thoughts on benchmarks? Your take?
There's definitely something to that. I don't know if test on prod is always the right answer. It certainly seems like a good way to go if you have users and you can try things out in the real world and like in a limited fashion, right? Obviously, you're not going to roll out the whole thing to every production user. Getting real feedback is the thing that matters. And, you know, I think you still can use benchmarks probably, right? And it makes sense. And probably you'll develop, like with the AI dashboards, develop some of your own internal benchmarks about like, oh, okay, this is what it means for it to be right or for the search quality. But like, you do need to be really careful that you don't over-optimize for those. And I think there's a real danger of that.
All right, up in front.
Oh, well, my name is Karsten. I'm an architect. I wanted to ask you a question about unit economics. So in my function as an architect, I often have to talk to customers about, you know, this perceived impact on cost if you run an LLM search versus a traditional search infrastructure. So as you look toward the future, what do you see are the major ingredients to bring that cost down and to make it more profitable and more competitive to where companies like Google, for example, are at the moment?
Yeah, so one advantage we have as a startup is we don't have the user volume that Google has, like 1 or 2 billion people using it every day. We don't have that, right? We are like orders of magnitude lower than that. So this cost is not a big deal. And in terms of reduction, moving to smaller models, that are trained explicitly for retrieval augmented is going to be helpful. And I expect hardware will also become cheaper over time. There'll be more tricks to make inference more efficient, like flash attention and like other techniques. FP8, all that things will help. And so considering that, as well as the fact that we don't need to worry about Google's user volume for quite a long while. I mean, if that were the case today, then we'd be a much bigger company. All that makes it much more convenient for us to do this whole thing. And of course, building our own index will also be a big cost reduction. Because once you index it, it's not a lot of cost for retrieval, right?
Hi, I'm curious if you've done any looking at groups of use cases or user personas and how you'd compare and contrast those against more traditional like Google search.
We found like a lot of users like using it for research. Usually you say, you know, but did you Google it for stuff that you would just get the answer very fast. What's the time in London right now? Like, that, those are Google nails those things. But for stuff where you have to actually go ask, does YC support founders if they're still having their jobs at their current companies? Or are they okay investing in their company as long until they get the funding? If you have to find out, it's going to be like opening a bunch of links and reading them. These are questions that Perplexity just answers. Like, so lots of these questions that you have in your day-to-day life that involve you to like do some amount of research, whether it's a few minutes or a few hours, our product just nails it, and that's where we have found a lot of usage. And hence why I think it's not really like a Google competition, even though that's what the narrative is, very easy to say that. It's more like opening a new segment for these answer bots that support people to come do their research directly.
So I guess I want to ask about your kind of 10-year plan and kind of what trends you're seeing on the technical and business side. So one example might be agents, and we know they really don't work very well right now, as Josh mentioned. Do you think users are going to expect the search tool to be able to do a lot of that research and ask those follow-up questions on their own? And how specialized do you think a tool like that would be with domain knowledge versus some general tool like Perplexity?
For the agent stuff, we're already sort of prototyping things there. So in Perplexity, if you turn on Copilot, it's more like an interactive search companion rather than just an answer bot. By that, I mean it'll come back and ask you clarifying questions. And the clarifying questions are very specific to the original question you asked. And it generates the UI for the clarifying questions. So that was an idea inspired by AutoGPT, but not completely autonomous. It's more like a co-pilot that works together. And you can imagine this heading towards like helping you buy stuff and over time, like do shopping decisions. So I certainly see possibilities to make this a reliable assistant over time and not just an answer engine. But we need to really make it work or else we'll not ship this, right? If it doesn't work for most people, it's going to make it a bad experience. 10-year plan, I think this could definitely work in even like 3 to 4 years. Beyond 5, it's really hard to predict. GPT-1 came out in 2018, so now it's 5 years from then. Would you have predicted this moment? It's pretty hard. So even 5 years is hard. So 10 years is like really, really hard.
Yeah. I had a question about training. You're talking about building your own models. And right now it sounds like you have a composite of a number of different search sources. How will your model be better than the best possible combination of those search sources?
You shouldn't train your models for this purpose, right? That's sort of why I'm very skeptical of generally like domain-specific LLMs. Because once you do that, these models lose the magic of the generality of the LLM. It'll be hard to keep it conversational. It'll be hard to do reasoning. All the stuff that makes a product feel magical when it's sort of built on top of OpenAI's API will all go away once you start fine-tuning on your use case alone. So how do you preserve the generality and yet optimize for your use case is kind of the open question. And I think the answer is like lies in some few papers published by Google. There's a paper published by Google called Minerva. It's a model that's trained to do math, answer calculus questions, things like that. But they did not just train it on math. They took Palm, but in fine-tuning phase, they don't just train on math, but they also train on regular English. In fact, 95% of the training is just on English, and maybe like 5%, 5 to 10% is on like math. And that ensures that they preserve the pre-training data distribution even while fine-tuning. And this is pretty important. Not a lot of people know this. And so when everyone complains that they took Llama and fine-tune it on this new thing, and then it overfit and it's not doing most of the general things it was able to do before. And there's a reason for that, like you're drifting too much from the initial parameter space.
All right. Thank you all so much. And thank you, Aravind. Yeah, quick round of applause for Aravind.